From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Condoleezza Rice grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, where she saw white supremacy up close. Now she's about to be the face of U.S. global supremacy to the world. I don't think it's quite what Dr. King had in mind.
The confirmation hearings of Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State begin today. The president hopes to have her sworn in by Election Day. We'll speak with author and radio talk show host Laura Flanders. It's called Black Reconnaissance. Special forces are conducting covert operations in as many as 10 countries in the Middle East and South Asia. The administration is conducting secret reconnaissance missions inside Iran since last summer. We'll speak with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh is reporting the Pentagon has secretly sent troops inside Iran to identify possible military targets. U.S. forces have reportedly entered into eastern Iran from Afghanistan. According to Hersh's piece in the New Yorker magazine, the president has authorized the Pentagon to send secret commando forces into as many as 10 nations in the Middle East and South Asia. The secret forces could potentially carry out combat operations or even terrorist acts. Unlike secret CIA missions, the Pentagon can operate completely off the books without congressional oversight. On Monday, the Pentagon criticized the article, but President Bush told NBC News he would not rule out taking military action against Iran. We'll speak with Seymour Hersh in just a few minutes. On Capitol Hill today, the Senate will begin holding confirmation hearings for Secretary of State nominee Condoleezza Rice. The White House is hoping to have her approved by Thursday's presidential inauguration. As President Bush's national security advisor, Rice was a chief backer of the U.S. invasion and even warned Iraq may use nuclear weapons. In September 2002, Rice said, quote, "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." In the second half of the program, we'll talk about Condoleezza Rice's record with Laura Flanders. Meanwhile, in Iraq, dozens of people have died in recent days as opponents of the U.S. occupation stepped up attacks ahead of the January 30th election. In Mosul, gunmen kidnapped one of the country's most prominent Catholic leaders, Archbishop Asile Jorge's Kasmusa of Mosul. The bishop was released earlier today. Pre-election attacks have also spread to the south, an area that had been peaceful. With less than 2 weeks before the vote, most candidates have still not publicly announced their candidacy out of safety concerns. Candidates are not campaigning. The locations of polling places are secret, and it's now unclear how many people will be able to get to the polls. Iraq's Election Commission is considering banning all vehicular traffic on Election Day. In addition, officials announced Iraq would close all its borders for 3 days ahead of the election. Journalist Robert Fisk, who just returned to Baghdad, describes it as, quote, a city of fear filled with, quote, fearful Iraqis, fearful militiamen, fearful American soldiers, and fearful journalists. Today, a car bomb exploded outside the Baghdad office of the leading Shiite political party. At least 2 people died. Also today, Iraqi militants released a video showing they had captured 8 Chinese hostages. They threatened to kill them in 48 hours unless China clarifies its role in Iraq. Meanwhile, President Bush has told the Washington Post that because of his election victory, there's no reason to hold any administration officials accountable for mistakes or misjudgments in pre-war planning or managing the deadly aftermath in Iraq. Bush described the elections as a, quote, accountability moment. He said, "The American people listened to different assessments made about what was taking place in Iraq, and they looked at the 2 candidates and chose me." However, a new Washington Post ABC News poll has found that 58% of the country now disapprove of how President Bush has handled the situation in Iraq. In other Iraq news, Army reservist Charles Grainer was sentenced Friday to 10 years in military prison for his role in torturing Iraqi detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison. Grainer was accused of stacking naked prisoners in a human pyramid and later ordering them to masturbate while other soldiers took photographs. He also allegedly punched one man in the head hard enough to knock him out and struck an injured prisoner with a collapsible metal stick. Grainer told jurors he was ordered to abuse the detainees. So far, none of Grainer's superiors have been charged with any crimes. And the Observer newspaper of London reports the two U.S. military contractors most connected to the torture at Abu Ghraib continue to receive millions in Pentagon contracts. CACI International has been awarded a $16 million renewal of its contract, and the company Titan has been awarded a new contract worth $164 million. Human rights groups have called for the firms to be barred from new contracts in Iraq. A former Haitian death squad leader now living in New York City has been sued by three Haitian women. They accuse Emmanuel Toto Constant of torture, crimes against humanity, and systematic use of violence against women to terrorize the Haitian population in the early 90s. Constant served as leader of the FRAP. Human rights groups estimate that between 91 and 94 coup, FRAP killed thousands of supporters of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Constant has since admitted that at the time he was on the payroll of the CIA. Since 1996, he's lived in Queens, New York. In election news, while appearing at a celebration honoring Dr. Martin Luther King in Boston, Senator John Kerry criticized in his harshest words yet the presidential vote in Ohio. He charged that in Ohio, quote, thousands of people were suppressed in the effort to vote. Until now, Kerry has largely been silent on the controversial Ohio vote. 2 weeks ago, he declined to join California Senator Barbara Boxer to protest the counting of Ohio's electoral vote. In education news, Harvard University President Lawrence Summers is coming under criticism for claiming that men outperform women in math and sciences, not because of discriminatory educational practices, but for biological reasons. Summers also claimed that discrimination is longer a career barrier for female academics. At Harvard, however, women continue to face a greater challenge getting tenured positions. During Summers' presidency, the number of tenured jobs offered to women has fallen from 36% to 13%. Last year, only 4 of 32 tenured job openings were offered to women. Again, Larry Summers claiming that discrimination is no longer a career barrier for female academics. The Israeli government is threatening to launch a large-scale attack in Gaza if newly elected Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas fails to stop Palestinian militants from carrying out attacks. On Friday, the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon cut off ties to the new Palestinian government just a day before Abbas was sworn in. On Saturday, Israeli forces killed 8 Palestinians in Gaza. On Thursday, Palestinian militants attacked a border crossing, killing 6 Israelis. In China, former Prime Minister Zhao Ziyang has died at the age of 86. He'd lived the last 15 years under house arrest after being purged from the government for opposing the use of military force to crush the pro-democracy demonstrations in Tiananmen Square in 1989. Award-winning journalist Wilbur Rito has been freed from jail after 44 years in prison. After he was jailed in 1961 for killing a bank teller, Wilbert Rito learned to read and write. He eventually started his own publication called The Lifer and became the editor of The Angolite at the Angola prison in Louisiana. In 1977, The Angolite became the first prison publication ever nominated for the National Magazine Awards. He also wrote and narrated an Oscar-winning National Public Radio documentary and directed the Oscar-nominated documentary The Farm. In 1999, Rito said, quote, "I didn't want a criminal act to be the final definition of me. I picked up a pen and tried to do something good. It allowed me to weave meaning into what would have been a meaningless existence. It also gave me a chance to try to make amends." And in California, lawyers are calling on Governor Schwarzenegger to grant clemency to their client, Donald Beardsley, because they've uncovered new evidence, they say, that he's suffering from brain damage. He's scheduled to die from lethal injection just after midnight Wednesday. He'd become the first person executed in California in 3 years. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Just days before President Bush's second inauguration, a new report reveals Bush administration intentions for military action against another member of his so-called axis of evil, Iran. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh is reporting in this week's The New Yorker magazine that the Pentagon's already secretly sent in forces to Iran to identify possible future military targets. Hersh writes he had been repeatedly told by intelligence and military officials on condition of anonymity that, quote, the next strategic target is Iran. One government consultant told Hersh, quote, the civilians in the Pentagon want to go into Iran and destroy as much of the military infrastructure as possible. The secret reconnaissance missions have been underway since at least last summer, with aid from Pakistan as well as Israel. According to Hersh's article, the president has authorized the Pentagon to send in secret commando forces into as many as 10 nations in the Middle East and South Asia. Secret forces could potentially carry out combat operations or even terrorist acts. Bush reportedly used the Pentagon for the missions instead of the CIA to avoid having to report to Congress. On Monday, the Pentagon criticized major aspects of Hersh's story, saying in a written statement, quote, Hersh's article is so riddled with errors of fundamental fact that the credibility of his entire piece is destroyed. But President Bush told NBC News he would not rule out taking military action against Iran. NBC's David Gregory sat down with the president at the White House and asked him about Iran.
About Iran. Will you rule out the potential for military action against Iran if it continues to stonewall the international community about the existence of its nuclear weapons program?
I hope we can solve it diplomatically, but I will never take any option off the table.
Seymour Hersh is on the line with us now, investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine. Your response to what President Bush has said?
Well, I mean, that's the thing that's wonderful is about that is that, of course, if he really hopes we're doing something politically, he should join in with the talks that have been underway for more than a year. Since 2003, the EU, the European Union, primarily led by England, France, and Germany, have been in extensive negotiations with the Iranians. I think there's an understanding that Iran has ambitions to become a nuclear power. It's not there yet. And the goal of these talks is to offer them, I guess, and to use a cliche, the carrots they need in terms of increased trade and increased credits and dual-use goods. Goods that they've been denied since by sanctions because of their activities, in exchange for a commitment to stop. And the United States has not joined in those talks, absolutely has nothing to do with them. And in the article, as I'm sure you know, I quote a senior Western diplomat, while everybody's so nervous about being quoted about anything these days with this administration. Anyway, a senior European diplomat said to me, we're in a lose-lose position because as long as America doesn't join in these negotiations, we really don't have the leverage. What kind of a commitment can we make for Iran's security if America stays out of it? And as long as they don't join in, we'll eventually going to have to go to the United Nations for sanctions because we can't do it through diplomacy to stop them. And at that point, everybody understands that Russia and China will probably veto it, and then the Bush administration can claim UN isn't working again, which is, of course, analogous to what happened in 2003 when we went into Iraq. We didn't give the negotiations there a chance to work. So if you're really interested in negotiations, it's real simple. Start talking to Iran.
Seymour Hersh, can you explain where the CIA and the Pentagon fits into this picture?
Well, that's actually, the most interesting part of the story I wrote, not about Iran, because, you could almost argue that, of course, we're doing surveillance. I'm sort of amazed that it became such a big story in the last 24 hours or so, 36 hours. The real issue is that what the story is about is the fact that the diminution of the CIA is unbelievable. The president has really gone after the agency with Cheney and Rumsfeld. And at this point, as I say, there's never been more significant or more intellectual or more intelligence capability for not only operations but for analysis. More is totally centralized in the White House and the Pentagon than ever than since the rise of the national security state after World War II in the Cold War. We now have the White House and a Pentagon that basically dominate the process. The CIA has been marginalized. All of the noise you heard about the new CIA director, Goss, going after people in the operations division, the so-called Dirty Tricks division, really has masked what's going on. His real mission, his real agenda, and it wasn't his, he was carrying out a White House agenda, was to get rid of a number of analysts, senior analysts who work for the intelligence side of the CIA, old-timers who have been skeptical of many of the White House's and Pentagon's operations. And so, as somebody said to me, they really went after the apostates, and they want only true believers in there, and that's what the real mission has been. And so the Pentagon now, under a series of presidential formal findings and also just declarations, I think the president has a lot of legal power here. The way the world shakes down is this: when it comes to covert secret operations abroad, if the CIA does it, under the law now, they must tell the president. The president has to issue a finding approving it, and the Congress has to be told. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees have to be briefed. If the military does a covert operation, their interpretation of the law is simply that the president's rights as commander-in-chief trump any other requirements. And that is, the military is there to prepare the battlefield with these operations. This is a military deal, totally. Nothing to do with intelligence. No need to inform anybody. So now Rumsfeld has won a major bureaucratic fight. He's now operating, as you said in the intro, up to 10 countries. He's sending in covert teams. That is what the word they use inside is wiped clean. The soldiers are wiped clean. Their IDs are totally non-American, non-military. They're going in to make contact with groups inside various countries, set up operations, try and do some war games, some terrorism themselves. You have to run with the bad boys to find the bad boys, is the way somebody said to me. In other words, look like bad boys to attract other bad boys so we find out who they are. We can't find the terrorists too often. This is one way of getting at them. And we're going to be doing that with military people. We're not going to be telling the American ambassador in the country. We're not going to be telling the CIA station chief. It's going to be done by Rummy and his people. And that's a huge shift, an unprecedented shift in the last 60 years.
Can you talk about, when it comes to Iran, the role of Pakistan and Israel?
Well, Israel's role is simply to say, if you guys don't do it, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. Nobody wants that. And so Israel's sort of there, and Israel's playing it very, very cleverly. And they understand that a lot of Americans, pro and anti-Israel, are troubled by the Israeli connection to this administration as it played out in the Iraqi invasion. You know, there's a lot of questions about whether Israel was a major player in this or a major factor. And so they don't want that scene replicated in case we do something in Iran. And so they've been lowballing it. But the reality is they've been putting a lot of pressure. And the message really to us is either you do it or we do it. And nobody, wants them to do it. That would be chaotic. I don't know why they think it's much better for us to do it. But in any case, and so their role, the Pakistani role is, of course, much more devious in a way, or much more complicated, because Musharraf is allegedly our ally in the hunt for bin Laden and all that. Meanwhile, he's going along making weapons and more nuclear weapons, but he has given us access to some of the Pakistani scientists who worked in Iran. One of the things we learned, one of the reasons we learned about Iran's secret ambitions is the International Agency for Atomic Energy, IAEA, the watchdog in Europe, in Vienna, of the non-proliferation regime, of which, by the way, Iran is a member of the NPT, Pakistan is not. Anyway, IAEA announced a couple of years ago that they discovered there was cheating, you know, gambling on the premises, that not only was Iran cheating, but they had been working with the Pakistanis for years. That all ended. But Musharraf has given us some of the Pakistani intelligence, some of the information they know from their own work about where certain facilities are inside Iran. And the exchange is we are laying off AQ Khan. AQ Khan's the sort of the mythical, it's not quite real, but we always call him the father of the Pakistani bomb. Actually, another man named Khan did much more with it. But nonetheless, AQ Khan was the guy that generated the dual-use goods, the materials they needed to get nuclear in the 70s and 80s. And he is a famous person, and he was caught out in Libya doing this kind of stuff a couple of years ago. And there was a public ceremony where Musharraf had AQ Khan went and apologized, and now he's been under house arrest. And Musharraf has not given us or the IAEA in Vienna access to this guy. So we don't know what he's doing. And my friends inside tell me we made a Faustian bargain. We told Musharraf, give us the intelligence we need to get more information about sites, nuclear sites or suspected sites in Iran, and we will not pressure you on AQ Khan, coughing him up to us or to the IAEA. And meanwhile, of course, Musharraf's making more bombs, and my other people tell me that people who know Pakistan, former Pakistanis, tell me that he's going and doing more work with the plutonium route. And, of course, they're into the international black market buying the parts right now. So it's, you know, it's amazing. We're sort of playing the short-run game. We need the intel. And I think the reason we need the intel is simply this. This president, yeah, I just have to listen to what he says. He's in the Washington Post last week in an astonishing interview. He's going ahead with the war on terror. He's continuing to do what he thinks is right to bring democracy. He almost basically, Iran, he said, is eagerly awaiting our help in becoming secular, or something like that, he said in the Washington Post. And I think we don't want to get the wrong targets. We don't want to be embarrassed again by, as in Iraq, with not coming up with WMD when we need to. So I think it all sort of fits together.
We're talking to investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. We have to break for just 1 minute. Then we come back. I want to ask you quickly about the conviction of Charles Grainer and also about Jerry Boykin's role in plans for Iran. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh in a minute.
خيال جوايا بالحب ابتديت واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش
Kantari, the fifth son, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on community radio stations, Pacifica Radio and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV, and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed captioning for for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, his latest piece is in the New Yorker magazine this week. It is called The Coming Wars, What the Pentagon Can Now Do in Secret, and talks about Pentagon plans to deal with Iran. Is it fair to say to attack Iran, Seymour Hersh?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Of course, they're planning to attack Iran. The goal of what we always call the neoconservatives, the Paul Wolfowitzes and Doug Feist in the Pentagon, the civilian leadership in the Pentagon, their theory is, look, one of the things they've learned in Iraq, they have learned something, which is that regime change by overwhelming force isn't working so well. So the goal in Iran, since it's also three times as large as Iraq, and it does have a large secular population, and there's a lot of reason to believe that if we hadn't gone into Iraq, there would be a lot of dissent right now in Iran over the leadership. But nonetheless, I think their thinking is that if we hit three or four dozen targets in the sprig, in the summer, late spring or summer, which I think is a tentative plan, that would be roughly at the time Sharon is beginning his pullout of Gaza. And so the theory is in the Pentagon there would be more good feelings towards America and the Muslim world once this begins. And if Iran can be stabilized, which they think it will, I don't know why, but they do after the elections. If that gets stabilized, then the goal is you hit three or four targets quickly and cleanly, and you be sure you're right, and you have evidence to show that the Iranians are cheating more than the world knows. This could lead to the secular population, those millions of young people, et cetera, who don't like the clerical leadership, to overthrowing or beginning to agitate against the mullahs once again. And the only problem with that thinking, of course, is that it's pretty much unique to the group of civilians in the Pentagon, because almost everybody else I talked to in and out of the government were scathing in their critique of this, as saying it's absolutely hogwash. So what's going to happen, of course, is that the White House and the Pentagon is ignoring the nationalism that exists, the enormous feelings of togetherness inside Iran and love for country. And essentially, the reason I think people talk to me, because it's very clear with this group that's now in the White House and in the Pentagon, you can't get to the meetings unless you drink the Kool-Aid. And so if you don't agree with them, you can't get in. And so, I think they really believe this is one way, sort of on the cheap, without committing a lot of troops, an air raid, maybe some commandos, some guerrillas, American SEALs or other teams go in with the Israelis, some Israeli commando units go into certain targets, about which were not clear. But basically, they think that's a ticket.
What are the other countries that the Pentagon is operating secretly in?
Well, unfortunately, one of the things I do is I like to avoid writing about anything where there's any chance that Americans there. I can't tell you there's any Americans going in and out of Iran right now. I know it started last summer. So there's plenty of protection there, besides which that they don't go in as Americans. But in the other countries, the countries I name, I can tell you we just did something in Algeria. What we are doing is we're sending in teams that are completely disguised as tourists. And the CIA has a number of rules they have to live by, which is they cannot, under the rules, they cannot have their assets, their people, posing as journalists or clerics. And there's no such rules for the Pentagon. So, the military people going in could be journalists, they could be religious people, they could be plain tourists. Undercover. And I think North Africa is a place of enormous interest for us because the Bush administration believes there's a lot of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-like terrorist activities there. So that's an area of concern. Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia. Obviously, they're still interested in the Philippines and Indonesia. And there's other countries where we have an enormous amount of interest.
The government has finally responded to your piece, if it didn't when you actually were calling the White House for response, saying it's so riddled with errors of fundamental fact that the credibility of your entire report has been destroyed.
Yeah, I heard that.
Your response?
Well, my response is pretty much the same as, I must say, even the mainstream media, to their everlasting credit, has all pointed out that while it's wonderful to go after me personally, none of the attacks dealt with the substance of what I was writing about. Are we operating in Iran? Has there been new understandings of what the Pentagon can do? All of that is not dealt with. And so, I'm really very untroubled by what Pentagon spokesmen say. I think when I did my stuff in Abu Ghraib, and suggested that what was going on in the New Yorker, I suggested, and there were a bunch of articles I wrote suggesting that went on in Abu Ghraib was certainly not just there, went on into Guantanamo in Cuba, into Afghanistan, other places in Iraq, and led to the highest leadership. When I wrote that stuff, they accused me of throwing mud up, or I think it was mud, against the wall and seeing what sticks. Well, and so, you know, we can just, you know, you can't worry about what public relations people say.
Speaking of which, conviction of Charles Grainer, sentenced to 10 years in prison for torture at Abu Ghraib.
Well, there's a couple thoughts. One, of course, is that just last week somebody got 1 year for murdering somebody in Iraq. It was a manslaughter case. So there's always a question of somebody else who pled guilty got 8 years, which are most of the people who are committed, you know, who shoot prisoners are getting 3 years or so. So there's that question of that, the fairness of the sentencing. Look, Grainer was certainly at fault, moronic, et cetera. But until this government, there are eight people have now been accused of activities in Abu Ghraib. A couple have pled guilty, or three or so, a couple awaiting trial, and a couple have found guilty. They're all enlisted people. And this is an operation that what happened in Abu Ghraib, which was excessive, went on for 3 or 4 months. Everybody knew what was going on in the night shift at the prison. I'm sure the same thing was going on in the day shift. And officer after officer was in. There's all sorts of allegations about visiting the site, as even including the major general or the three-star general in charge of the whole Iraqi operation. So we have all of Sanchez I'm talking about. We have all of these allegations. Not one officer has been charged. Grainer's defense was moronic, but one of the things his lawyer did raise, they tried very hard to get some officers as witnesses, and, of course, they all pled the military equivalent of the Fifth, and they were excused. They didn't testify. So we really don't. This trial doesn't do anything to get us. I thought the coverage in the Washington Post, by the way, which I read, I thought was really quite brilliant, because they kept on focusing on the trial, and the Grainer trial, about higher-ups. And I didn't see as much of that in the Times, unfortunately, but in the Post it was really terrific coverage, because that was the real theme of what Grainer was saying, is there were a lot of other people involved. Until we deal with that in a legal way, the Army, and prosecute some people, we're still in the scapegoat goat business here. And it's hard to have much sympathy for Grainer, but I learned when I did a lot of work on Milai, and I initially started out thinking all those kids in Lieutenant Calley's company who murdered people were the worst sort of people. In the end, I came to realize they were as much victims as the people they executed, because of wrong war, wrong time, wrong training, wrong everything. And there is a lot more responsibility than just Charlie Grainer's.
And your belief in having written Chain of Command, the book, how far up it goes?
Oh, my God. I don't think there's any question that I would never say that anybody in the White House or Pentagon knew, civilian leadership knew what was going on in Abu Ghraib, but that everybody from the president on down understood that, as the cliche was, the gloves are off, those who Rumsfeld kept on saying, that we were going to get very tough with prisoners. There's no question. It was widespread inside. And, as you remember, we talked about it. The book I wrote begins with a meeting with Condoleezza Rice about this issue. And there was a lot more high-level information. And, this president's hard for us to reach. We don't know, we don't know where he is at any time. But I'm increasingly convinced, and I have enough data that I'm getting, I'm just talking, I'm not writing, that the president, when it came to prisoner interrogation issues and the intelligence from it and operational stuff, is much more actively involved in a way we don't see than we might think. We always see him as sort of not really getting tuned in. I think in this kind of stuff, he's really more tuned in. But I have to prove that.
And finally, as we move into the Condoleezza Rice confirmation hearings today in the Senate, that opening scene in your book, Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, Condoleezza Rice convened. She was convinced, to her credit, to hold a meeting on all these allegations that came out of Guantanamo. A CIA official had gone down to Guantanamo. We're talking about in the summer of 2002, 6-9 months before the invasion of Iraq, long before Abu Ghraib, went down without clearance, went down and just spent time. Most of the congressional people and other visitors to Guantanamo were seeing what amounted to a Potemkin village. They would clean it up and give them the show and tell and hide what was really going on, the kind of daily brutality. He saw it, wrote a report. It got circulated. He was in the CIA, and it ended up in Condoleezza Rice's hands. Some of very people with a lot of integrity inside the NSC, National Security Council, insisted that it be dealt with. She convened a meeting. Rumsfeld came. He said he would do something about it. Nothing happened. Everybody was disillusioned, and everybody knew, and it just kept on going. It just never, you know, it's one of those issues. She did have a meeting about it, but nothing happened. Just sort of whittled away, and people kept on whacking people. And so the guys in the inside in the White House, including a four-star general, were very discouraged by it. And then when I wrote about Abu Ghraib, I learned about all this, and that was what I wrote about. That's actually the whole scene. The first 30 or 40 pages of the book is about this. So, you know, where's responsibility lie? You know, Condoleezza Rice was not at Abu Ghraib sticking feathers in people, but she certainly knew in general that things were not basically going right, and we were mistreating prisoners. And also, it's real simple. Two simple rules every military guy knows. One is you don't do to them what you don't want done to your soldiers, and two, you cannot get good intelligence from people that want to fly airplanes in the buildings to kill the infidels, to kill us. You can't get it by pushing them around. They have a story, and they'll just give you the story. You have to convince them otherwise. You have to establish rapport. And everybody knows that. And that's one of the, you know, anybody who argues that the torture is acceptable is really missing the boat on that issue. And most of the really good guys in the profession, which is one reason some of the guys in the FBI protested so much, because they knew that, you know, if you're rational and smart, you don't get it by pushing people around. And in any case, you know, it remains, I must say, in the last 6 months, thank God for the American ACLU and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. They've really pressed this issue. There's a group, a bar group in New York. Scott Horton is involved in it, a legal group that's also doing a lot of work. People at NYU, there's an awful lot of stuff going on now to try and hold, you know, in some way, because Congress isn't going to do it. The one thing we know is Congress is not going to do its job.
Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Investigative reporter, wrote the latest piece in the New Yorker magazine. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to Condoleezza Rice and the confirmation hearing that is taking place today, National Security Advisor Rice will appear before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for the start of her confirmation hearing as Secretary of State. Rice is a close confidant of President Bush, was one of the chief backers of the invasion of Iraq. In the months leading up to the war, she was one of the leading administration officials who warned Iraq was harboring stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. announced it ended the search for WMDs last week. Rice said Iraq tried to buy thousands of high-strength aluminum tubes that were, quote, only really suited for nuclear weapons programs, and said U.S. intelligence suggested that Iraqis had helped al-Qaeda to develop chemical weapons. In September 2002, Condoleezza Rice warned about Saddam Hussein's nuclear threat by saying, "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." In the early years of her career, Condoleezza Rice taught at Stanford and later rose to become the university's provost. She later worked with National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, under President George H.W. Bush. When his son, then Texas Governor George Bush, declared his candidacy for the 2000 presidential race, Rice was one of his most trusted advisors and served as one of the 10 members on his handpicked Presidential Exploratory Committee. President Bush wants Condoleezza Rice to be sworn in by Inauguration Day. If so, she'll become the first female African-American Secretary of State. Dr. Rice's position on race has frequently come under criticism in the past. In January 2003, in the report in the Washington Post, credited Rice with helping to shape the administration's decision to challenge the affirmative action admissions policy at University of Michigan. Our guest today is Laura Flanders. She wrote the book Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and focuses on Dr. Condoleezza Rice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Laura.
Great to be here, Amy.
What do you expect from these hearings?
Well, they don't expect much, frankly. I mean, in a real world, a world that cared about human rights abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, a world that cared about the fact that there are no weapons of mass destruction, there is no freedom, there is no democracy in Iraq, Condoleezza Rice would be being fired along with those CBS producers. Instead, she's moving on up, and I suspect she will be given a pretty easy ride today and be able to continue her job as kind of the president's prop as he pursues his goals and Donald Rumsfeld's goals around the world. I mean, the timing is fantastic for her, and I think we will see a parade into the Senate hearing room today of her supporters and much made of her family background in Birmingham, Alabama, and the victory that it is for civil rights in the United States that she is becoming the first African-American Secretary of State. Sure, there's something to be said for that, but I really think that this is a woman who deserves very strict grilling, very stiff questioning on her record up to now, which is a record of, as far as I can say either dismal failure or utter mendacity lying to the American people and the world. That's what she deserves. I don't think it's what she's going to get.
We're talking to Laura Flanders. When we come back, we'll explore some very strong allegations here of mendacity, what Condoleezza Rice's role, what she said in the 9/11 hearing, what she said about nuclear weapons, about weapons of mass destruction, with Laura Flanders. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about Dr. Condoleezza Rice, who is going before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, confirmation hearings as Secretary of State. Our guest is Laura Flanders, a radio talk show host on Air America, also author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species. Let's go back to the 9/11 Commission hearings, when one of the commission members, Richard Benveniste, was questioning Condoleezza Rice.
You acknowledged to us in your interview of February 7, 2004, that Richard Clark told you that Al-Qaeda cells were in the United States. Did you tell the president at any time prior to August 6 of the existence of Al-Qaeda cells in the United States?
First, let me just make certain.
If you could just answer that question,
first,
because I only have a very limited.
I understand, Commissioner, but it's also important, Commissioner, that I address the other issues that you have raised. So I will do it quickly, but if you'll just give me a moment.
Well, my only question to you is whether you told the president.
If you'll just give me a moment, I will address fully the questions that you've asked. First of all, yes, the August 6th PDB was in response to questions of the president. In that sense, he asked that this be done. It was not a particular threat report. And there was historical information in there about various aspects of Al-Qaeda's operations. Dick Clark had told me, I think in a memorandum, I remember it as being only a line or two, that there were Al-Qaeda cells in the United States. Now, the question is, what did we need to do about that? And I also understood that that was what the FBI was doing, that the FBI was pursuing these Al-Qaeda cells. I believe in the August 6th memorandum, it says that there were 70 full field investigations underway of these cells. And so there was no recommendation that we do something about this. The FBI was pursuing it. I really don't remember, Commissioner, whether I discussed this with the president.
Thank you.
I remember very well that the president was aware that there were issues inside the United States. He talked to people about this, but I don't remember the Al-Qaeda cells as being something that we were told we needed to do something about.
Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6th PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
That was Condoleezza Rice being questioned by one of the 9/11 Commission members, Richard Benveniste. Laura Flanders.
Well, she obviously has a faulty memory. I mean, she thinks she was given a line or two by Richard Clark. He has a very different opinion of what happened there. She doesn't remember being told that Al-Qaeda was anything she had to do anything about. She would have to have been told that, as far as we know, with the Clinton administration outgoing as they left. That was their number one issue in their incoming briefings of her and her team. So on her memory alone, she should not be sent to any higher office, let alone Secretary of State. I mean, I think what we're going to see in the hearings today is Condoleezza Rice defend her right or assert her right not to talk about her counsel to George W. Bush, either with regard to that August PBB or about the Gonzales memo, which Cy Hirsch mentioned earlier on. It's true. In January of 2002, she was one of those who gave the president advice on what to make of the dispute then between Alberto Gonzalez and most of the military chiefs, including Colin Powell, about whether the Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees should be extended Geneva Convention protections. We want to know where she stood on that. The New York Times suggests she sided with Gonzalez and with Bush and against Colin Powell, but we would be well served to find out what was the truth and have her ask that. I suspect she'll say, that's going into, you know, personal privilege with the president. I won't talk about it. In which case, we need the senators to ask her about policy going forward. What does she, where is she in regard to the Geneva Convention and international law more broadly? This is somebody who you go back into her history before she ever served in this Bush administration, when she was at Stanford and when she was writing for Foreign Affairs magazine before the election campaign of 2000. She wrote that the United States has an individual interest, that every nation has an individual interest to advance its own goals, that there is no such thing as a community of nations with shared interests, which I think is a very important thing to realize about her mindset as she goes off to be our emissary to the world. Here is somebody who doesn't believe that nations should work together to advance shared goals, but rather that each individual nation should pursue their individual goals and that the U.S. has a right to use really whatever means they want to achieve theirs. That's a very, very frightening prospect for a Secretary of State, and the world should know it if that's where she stands and get prepared.
You wrote in your book, Bush Women, the big thing about Rice is that she was doggedly, disastrously wrong on the most important development to take place on her watch in her policy area, but you weren't talking about her policy views on Iraq, but on the Soviet Union 15 years ago.
Well, I mean, we are going to hear endlessly this morning how brilliant Condoleezza Rice is, and while I'm no expert to scrutinize her writing on the Czech army in the late 1970s, the first book that she had out, I've read very damning reviews even of that, and with respect to, her expertise about the Soviet Union, here she was, the top Soviet expert, 1989, did not see the collapse of the Soviet Union coming. I mean, there have been so many more failures since then, one hardly knows where to start. But looking forward, we need to understand that this is a woman. It's interesting that the New York Times, for example, yesterday is laying out the suggestion that because Condoleezza Rice is so close to George W. Bush, she will be able to challenge him more. Unlike Colin Powell, they wrote yesterday, Todd Purdom, she may be able to tussle with him better. I see no evidence that she disagrees with him in his policies in any major way. And I think that this is once again trying to maintain the illusion that there is diversity, to use the word, that there is diversity of opinion inside the cabinet. There isn't. George Bush is surrounded by yes men, whatever their race, whatever their gender, I'm afraid.
The Los Angeles Times had an interesting piece this weekend called Not Always Diplomatic in Her First Major Post. Condoleezza Rice, about to become Secretary of State, was a divisive figure at Stanford. And The LA Times writes, the biggest controversy of Rice's tenure involved the treatment of women and minorities. Stanford had a history of complaints regarding alleged bias. Many considered Rice's appointment an effort to address those concerns in dramatic fashion. It would be disingenuous for me to say that the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was black, and the fact she was young weren't in my mind. Casper told The New Yorker in 2002 they were. Some who believed Rice would emerge as a champion of blacks and women were disappointed. And it says Rice drew protests and prompted a student hunger strike when she fired the university's highest-ranking Latina administrator acting when the campus was cleared for spring break. The Stanford Daily stated at the time, a drive-by firing. She further alienated minority students by unsuccessfully seeking to consolidate the university's ethnic community centers in a single building. The most serious complaints alleged Rice and other Stanford administrators thwarted the advancement of women and minorities.
Yeah, Casper was the university president at the time, brought her in as his budget cutter. They were facing severe budget cuts, and here she was, and what did she cut? She cut the minority programs, and she did everything she could to stymie legal cases brought by women against Stanford on the basis of discrimination. It reminds me of what Lawrence Summers said at the top of the hour when you reported on his record hiring women and people of color in the mathematics and science faculties. Stanford has a terrible record, had a terrible record then, went to arbitration, actually, on these cases. She was brought in to cut back the budget, to implement these budget cuts, and he was right when he admitted that her race and her gender had something to do with it. I spoke to people involved in that situation then, and they said she did things and said things that no white man would ever have gotten away with, and I think that that's been true of her career. Interestingly, at the time, she talked about affirmative action so as to say, well, I believe in affirmative action in hiring, but not in promotion, which betrays an utter ignorance, again, of how our affirmative action mandates work. They're supposed to be implemented both in gathering information and in hiring and in promotion. So again, she's given credit for knowing about things that she doesn't know anything about, and the things that she's supposed to know so much about, there are some really large questions about what she knows and what she hides.
And the Washington Post crediting Dr. Rice with helping to shape the administration's decision to challenge the University of Michigan affirmative action?
Well, there it's a little bit complicated. I think that, in fact, they did a sort of two-step role in regard to Michigan. George Bush went very public saying that he opposed affirmative action in every way. She more privately said, no, actually, we do believe there's a role for the consideration of race in admissions. What I think they were doing was trying to speak to two constituencies at once, the hard right who want to do away with affirmative action and the sort of moderate center who don't want to be seen to have those views. So she helps them put several faces to the world. But I think the most important thing for us to realize going forth with her as Secretary of State is that she is somebody who believes in unilateralism. I mean, again, to go back to the top of the program, this is the day after the day that we commemorate Dr. King's birthday, and she will talk, I'm sure, about her history in Birmingham and how she was 8 years old when the girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church were killed, and she knew two of them. She saw white supremacy up close, and she'll talk about that, I'm sure, today. What won't be discussed, I'm afraid, is the role the U.S. is playing now as a global supremacist power that assumes one set of rights for itself and one set of rights for every other nation in the world. And Condoleezza Rice has believed that the U.S. and U.S. corporations, and let's not forget her 10 years at Chevron, had every right to take what they wanted in the way of resources, in the way of corporate reach around the world, at whatever the cost to the people in those countries. And we're seeing now in Iraq, an Iraq that was promised it would be brought freedom, an Iraq that was promised it would be brought democracy, nothing resembling either. What Robert Fisk said, fear on every front. And Condoleezza Rice is responsible for that, and she needs to be held to account for that. And the world needs to realize, I think, that if there was any dissent inside the administration with Colin Powell, even the pretense of that is now gone. This is somebody who, as far as we know, has nothing but disdain for international law and has written that she doesn't believe in a community of nations. That's a very frightening thought.
her allegation pushing forward very early on the idea of the mushroom cloud, and then the insertion in the speech of the State of the Union address that Saddam Hussein was about to get nuclear weapons, her involvement, her aide's involvement, who will be replacing her as national security advisor.
Yeah, I mean, she was there both parroting what the president had to say, giving him lines. She did. She said to CNN in September of 2002, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Just days later, the president used that very same word. Others were using it too. She also talked about that we must bring democracy to Baghdad. And I think that she actually said we must bring democracy to Baghdad as we brought democracy to Birmingham. And what we've seen now in the Washington Post is reports that indeed, Iraq has become a training ground, a breeding ground for more insurgency, more terrorism, more resistance. She was put on the top. She was put to head the Iraq Stabilization Group in October of 2003. You ask about her involvement. George Bush considered her a very key player in crafting and coordinating Iraq policy, such that in October of 2003, when things were already not going really well, she was put at the top of this group that was supposed to coordinate reconstruction, democracy building, media, and security. Well, that stabilization group has been nothing but unstable. As far as we can see, 7 months after it was founded, all but one of its members had gone on to work in other capacities. She's, again, failed over and over again. But is she central? I think absolutely.
And her relationship with the Bush team, with Cheney, with Rumsfeld, with Wolfowitz.
Well, that's another interesting point. Cy Hirsch and others talking about how important Rumsfeld and Cheney are in this administration. She's been working with them since the first Bush administration. And as I write in my book, she entered this administration to rejoin Dick Cheney after the first Bush service, where she and Dick Cheney were on opposing sides of what to do about the Soviet Union. He supported regime change. He supported the breakup of the Soviet Union. She supported, much longer than he did, maintaining relations with Gorbachev and maintaining the Soviet Union as a single entity. In the eyes of the neocons, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Wolfowitz, she was wrong. He was right. She came into the first Bush administration with that history, which in my mind, I don't know the inner workings of the administration, but she must have come in wounded and weak. And they know, every time they talk about how brilliant she is, they know that she knows that they know that she was wrong. In 1989, in 1990. She left the first Bush administration under a cloud. So who has power in that negotiation between Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice? I don't think it's Rice.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Laura, for being with us. Laura Flanders is author of Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and she is the host of radio programs on the weekend on Air America. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I look forward to seeing our international listeners in Dublin, in Kildare, and in London on the weekend of January 29th and January 30th. Be in Kildare on Saturday at 2 and in the evening in Dublin, and on Sunday at the London School of Economics. So pass the word around. Our website is democracynow.org, and there you can sign up for our daily digest, our daily headlines and media alerts. That's democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow as we bring you the latest news from the Condoleezza Rice hearings, analysis, and excerpts of those hearings. Condoleezza Rice could be sworn in as Secretary of State as early as Inauguration Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.